The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Florence Nash from Triangle Radio Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the AARP magazine for February-March. Got a little bit of that left to read, and then I'll be reading to you a couple of articles from the New York Times. Today's programming is generously underwritten by Salibi Chiropractic. Salibi Chiropractic welcomes the geriatric community with any neck, back, or hip issues. Call 919-782-4733. Again, that's 919-782-4733. Now, we're going to start off with an article from the Personal Best section of AARP magazine, My Sentence. The title is Burned to the Waterline. After a reckless afternoon caused unthinkable harm, author Donovan Webster needed to find a way to begin again. Every evening since I got out, I've taken a walk just to see the stars and the moon and to listen to the night. Where I live now, there's a little more than 70 acres of Virginia farmland to kick around on, patrolled by an owl that, on some nights, I hear glide from the woods to hunt rodents, scratching for grain near an empty horse shed. It's not my farm. Good friends have lent me a guest apartment at their place to stay in for as long as I need it, which is generous of them, because for 21 months I never got to see the stars and the moon, because I was in prison. Late on the afternoon of August 14, 2014, in the mood to celebrate a potential two-book publishing deal, I decided to take myself fly fishing. I went over the mountain from where I lived then in central Virginia to the Shenandoah Valley and an easily accessible trout stream. I put four beers into the car, thinking, why not? When I got over to the stream, the afternoon sun shone hard on the water and the fish had yet to start moving in the river's shadows. I scouted the location a bit and finished two beers as I listened to the car radio. Then I went down the street to the local fly fishing shop and talked to the guys who run it for an hour or so. Back at the river, there was still nothing going on, so I pulled out a third beer and knocked it back. Then I took out the fourth one, popped it, and began thinking, you're probably getting close. I decided to scout a shaded stream on the other side of the mountain. Driving back down the mountain on a blind turn, I glanced down from the road to check my speed, and at once everything changed, because when I looked up, a blue car appeared suddenly from behind the curve and was now right in front of me. The man in the blue car was named Wayne T. White. He was a husband and father and grandfather, a farmer and churchgoer. He was said to be an exemplary human being. Up until that day, I'd had a pretty good career, traveling the world as a war correspondent, author, and sometime filmmaker. I could get pretty much anyone on the telephone to answer an email. I felt myself at the center of things, and while the descent from that lofty place to a state prison might have felt sudden, the sky didn't fall in all at once. I had spent the previous two decades being paid to look directly at things that make most people avert their eyes. I'd witnessed bloody rebellions in Africa, covered war in Iraq and Afghanistan. I volunteered to cover these situations, the bombings, the torture, the beheadings, all of it. Then I'd go home to Virginia to sit in a lonely room by myself, sort it out and write it up, and, well, I'd loosen the screws at night with a couple of beers and a glass of wine at dinner. Reporting was my passion. But as I got older, the stuff I had seen began to collect in my mind, and it was increasingly difficult to get away from it. Then came the Southeast Asian tsunami of December 2004. I was sent all across the Indian Ocean basin by the United Nations as part of a team to write a report on the aftermath. This assignment was different. Everything inside the tsunami zone was gone. There were no houses, no trees, nothing but bloated corpses, mostly naked. The violence of the tsunami had stripped away the clothes of the victims, thousands of them, rotting in the sun. Inside the zone, we all wore surgical-style masks. If you didn't, tiny particles of dust and rotting human flesh blown on the wind would attach themselves to your teeth and tongue and the roof of your mouth. Not surprisingly, the weight of these things took a toll. A few months later, I began to have debilitating panic attacks. Since 2007, I have been diagnosed 3 times with post-traumatic stress disorder. It happens to reporters as well as soldiers. Psychiatrists prescribed Lexapro for depression and anxiety, Valium for low-level anxiousness, Xanax for full-on panic attacks, and Trazodone to help me get to sleep at night. The drugs turned me into Mr. Magoo, so I put them aside and instead began hitting the sauce harder. I never saw my drinking as out of control, but slowly, like a cresting wave, it was getting less and less manageable. Though I ran between 5 and 7 miles a day, my body wasn't as good at alcohol anymore, a phenomenon doctors say isn't unusual when we enter our 50s, and the volume was increasing without my really noticing or caring. A few beers after dinner, maybe a handful of scotches or bourbons after my middle school teacher wife retired to bed at about 9:30. I didn't intend for it to become a habit. It just did. There were months at a time when I was reporting in Saudi Arabia or Islamic North Africa, where alcohol is prohibited, when I didn't drink at all. But once I got back home, my old drinking habits kicked in. On that blind mountain curve, I sideswiped Wayne T. White's car. He went back over into his lane, slowed down, and an 18-wheeler crashed on top of him. Mr. White lost his life. The Commonwealth of Virginia would find that I had a blood alcohol level of 0.10%. The legal limit in the state is 0.08%. So my life, as I knew it, was lost too. Not a day goes by that I don't wake up and think of Wayne T. White and the White family and what I took from them. Every day I feel terribly, knee-bucklingly awful about it. And not a day goes by that I don't stagger a little bit, wounded by what a split second did to my own life and to my family as well. We lived in a small town. Everyone knew who I was, and everyone also knew my wife. And when I went to prison for killing a man, she became the public face of our family and my deed. It shamed her unbearably. So she sold our house and some of our possessions and moved back to her hometown in Tennessee. I can't blame her. She'd met her limit. My son and daughter are divided between wanting to love me and wanting to walk away from all the pain. When they were younger, I coached them in baseball and soccer, did homework with them, paid for private schools and vacations, and did local theater with them, where I was a kick-ass Captain Von Trapp. But they're understandably cautious with their love now. And as for that star-spangled career, it won't surprise you to learn that almost everyone I used to work with, to generally happy and successful results, is tentative about going in with me. And few new prospects seem willing to go too far down the road with a man who pleaded guilty to involuntary manslaughter. The damage left by the accident and by the almost 2 years in prison shows itself in large and small ways. My wife, who comes back to visit regularly, says I scream and thrash in my sleep. And the way I dress has changed. I used to wear blue button-down shirts all the time. I had dozens of these shirts from Brooks Brothers and Joseph A. Bank and Orvis and Tommy Bahama and L.L. Bean and other stores. In prison, blue button-down chambray shirts are what you're given to wear, which means that now on this side of the razor wire, I can't wear blue shirts. I threw them all away. In prison, I read a book a day and lived on public radio. I went to bed early, and every night, weather permitting, before the guards closed the yard, I would go out and watch the sun go down. The other offenders left me alone on a bench in the evenings to let me watch the sky, the jets, and their contrails tracking through it. The guards allowed me out until last call, after they had rounded up everybody else. But we all had to be back in our cells by sundown. I never really got to see the night sky. On the Tuesday morning of my release, my children came to pick me up. They were in my daughter's Volvo station wagon. As soon as I'd settled in the car's back seat, I started to cry silently. I wasn't crying for me. Instead, it was for what I'd done to the White family, to my children, to my wife and father and brother and sister. I had no way to make that right. I told the kids I wanted more than anything in the world a chocolate milkshake from Chick-fil-A. For nearly 2 years, I'd missed chocolate milkshakes. But as we drove in the direction of a friendly fast food window, I tried to think about what was next. Now, after a little more than a year back in the real world, a new sense of freedom has slowly risen up, like spring water deep in a well. I still struggle, but I go to counseling, take my therapy, and do my daily best to guard my sobriety. On occasion, I've succumbed to despair, though I refuse to give up my commitment to recovery. To my surprise, many of my anxiety-related problems have diminished substantially. As I slowly age toward 60, with a broken family, virtually no money, nothing great in the way of work prospects, and only my wits and a few friends who love me still around, I have a powerful remorse for the damage I have caused. But what I don't have, perhaps because I simply can't afford it, is self-pity. Yes, there are moments when I walk out under the night sky and ask myself what the point of this journey has been. But feeling sorry for oneself is a luxury people my age can no longer afford. Virtually everything in my life burned to the waterline. But I have realized that there's some great power in being around long enough to comprehend that no matter the damage we've done, a new door will open. No matter what age you are, staging a comeback is only a matter of taking the rest of your life seriously and making the next smart step. And the next, is there really any other option? Donovan Webster, who was 59 when this was written, has written for The New Yorker, National Geographic, and other magazines. He's the author most recently of War Stories, True Life Fiction from America's Troops and Families in the Global War on Terror. Here's another little brief item under personal best. This is my fresh catch. Crescent City Cuisine. Restaurateur Ella Brennan relishes a flavorful seafood sauté. My big brother Owen earned the Vieux Carré, the Bourbon Street restaurant where Bananas Foster was invented. I began my career there when I was a teenager, working for him in the front of the house. I started running my own place with my siblings, Commander's Palace, in 1974. We have always been on the leading edge of Creole cuisine. I don't cook, but I love being in the kitchen and developing talent. We've had some great chefs at Commander's, including Paul Prudhomme and Emeril Lagasse. Right now, the chef is Tori McPhail, who is wonderful. Dining out is what you do in New Orleans. If you're lucky, you'll be invited over to a friend's house for a cocktail first. I keep a pitcher of old fashions and a bucket of ice just in case someone stops by. That's how we do things. When it comes to ingredients, New Orleans is lucky. While we have farms, we've got water, too, and that water produces great seafood. Just this week, my nephew brought me fresh-caught drum. I love the way Tori cooks it. I didn't plan on running restaurants my whole life, but I learned to love it very much. Love what you do, grow with it, and it becomes a lifestyle. I worked 7 days a week. I ate what I wanted and certainly wasn't bored. There was no time for that. Ella Brennan, who is now 92, owns Commander's Palace in New Orleans. She's the subject of the 2016 documentary, Ella Brennan, Commanding the Table. Another little article from AARP. This is AARP Foundation Fights Nursing Home Evictions. This is written by Eric J. Schneiderwind, who is the president and national volunteer spokesperson. He says, a hallmark of AARP is our work on behalf of the most vulnerable members of society. Many people in nursing homes have become victims of a troubling trend, illegal evictions. Patients Patient dumping occurs when a nursing home sends residents to institutions such as hospitals or even homeless shelters and refuses to readmit them. Evictions are a terrible blow to the patients and loved ones. Involuntary discharge from nursing homes is the leading complaint received by a long-term care ombudsman. Last year, a nursing home in Sacramento, California, refused to allow 82-year-old Gloria Single, who has Alzheimer's disease, back into the facility where she and her husband, 93, were living. The nursing home had sent her to the hospital for a psychological evaluation. Neither she nor her family consented to it, by the way, and the hospital had cleared her to return the same day. The nursing home defied the state of California, which ordered her readmission. That's when AARP Foundation stepped in and sued the nursing home. Gloria was in the hospital for 3 months before being admitted to a different nursing home, and by then the lack of stimulation had caused her to stop talking. Kelly Bagby, an attorney at AARP Foundation, says that until all states take action to protect residents, our only recourse is going to be filing lawsuits for people like Mrs. Single. We expect a precedent-setting decision later this year. Allison Herschel, who directs the Michigan Elder Justice Initiative in my home state, notes that residents in facilities that accept Medicaid and Medicare have strong federal protections. Nursing home residents can be moved only if the facility can't meet the patient's needs. The patient doesn't need the services, the health or safety of others is endangered, the patient won't pay, or the home closes. She says, however, that many states do not vigorously enforce protections, and many residents are unaware of the law or too intimidated to fight back. State ombudsmen can help nursing home residents who are treated unfairly. For more information, see the National Consumer Voice for Quality Long-Term Care site at theconsumervoice.org/get_help or call 202-332-2275. Meanwhile, the court should rule in Gloria's favor. She deserves to be reunited with her husband. You can write to Eric J. Schneiderwind at AARP 601 East Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20049, or email aarppresident@aarp.org. Now, this little bit is called Under Your AARP. This is under Outsmart Fraud. You are the target. Today's swindlers make their pitches entirely personal. Once, fraudsters blanketed as many people as possible with the same pitch, knowing they'd get a few takers. Today, that has turned around entirely. Scammers now work one person at a time. Consider it personal. Interviews with convicted swindlers and reviews of undercover tapes of con men in action reveal that successful scammers study you before striking. They use public data and your online behaviors to learn your background and situation. Then they apply these 5 proven techniques to individualize their pitches. Find the right moment. Whether it's the death of a family member, financial troubles, a disease diagnosis, or even just moving from one place to another, stressful life events seem to go hand in hand with being scammed. Why? One theory is that these stressful events require cognitive capacity that might otherwise be used to spot and resist con artists. Win your trust. U.S. military veterans tend to trust fellow vets, so swindlers have learned to pretend to be veterans. Likewise, the best way to scam someone in Iowa is to claim to be from Iowa. Deep in debt? A con artist often will weave a story that he or she, too, was deep in debt exactly like you and used this very service to successfully return to financial health. Locate your hot buttons. Once they have your trust, the best scammers ask questions about your life to find what one con man called your emotional Achilles heel. That could be fear of running out of money, concern for your spouse's health, or anger at how an organization has treated you. Swindlers are experts at empathy. What they lack is sympathy. Once they find your weak spot, they attack. Trigger your emotions. Con artists agree the key to a swindle is to get the victim into a heightened emotional state. Once they determine your hot button, they will push it hard using all kinds of verbal skills. Hurry you to say yes. Why do that? Because emotions make us act more quickly. That's why you should always hang up, cool down, do the research, and get an outside opinion before deciding on any unsolicited pitch. Chances are your more rational side will quickly tell you to walk away. Because when it comes to parting with your money, the very last thing this should be is personal. This was written by Doug Shadle, who is an AARP scam expert. Now, the Sunday, March 4 issue of the New York Times had a special issue on retirement, which had some interesting articles in it, and so here's one. This is Catching Up After a Recession. People who've struggled to replenish their lost retirement savings are now focusing on financial security, by Elizabeth Olson. A number of Americans had to delay their plans to retire when the economic crisis hit in 2008. Some lost their jobs, some took serious losses to their 401k plans, and some had to go back to work because of the shortfall in their retirement savings. In the decades since, people who were close to retirement have struggled to replenish their lost savings and now are focused on financial security. We revisited some near retirees who had been interviewed by the New York Times about coping during the recent recession, along with others who stepped up to tell the stories of how they managed in the ensuing years. Carol A. Schoberg, 70, planned to retire in 2013. Her actual retirement date was 2017. Ms. Schoberg worked as the human resources director at a sports league membership group in Milwaukee until the group decided after the 2008 recession to move out of state. But as a divorced mother of three children and grandmother of four, relocation was not possible for her. At 60, she was not ready to retire, and available jobs paid $20 an hour compared with her previous six-figure salary, so she began providing outplacement services. In 2011, she was hired full-time for an employer association and later became the director of roundtable meetings for its member businesses. I had to start all over and begin putting as much money away as I could, she said. But at age 70 and a half, federal law mandates a percentage of withdrawals from 401k savings. Last July, when she turned 70, Ms. Schoberg took part-time status to meet the federal requirement, but still contributed to her retirement. I'm probably at 70% of where my savings were in 2008, she said, and I still plan to work 2 days a week as long as I can. I enjoy it. Ned and Barbara Petrucci, who are 70 and 67, respectively, planned to retire in 2012. Their actual retirement date was 2013. When the Petruccis were interviewed for a 2009 Times article about older workers being unable to retire, Mr. Petrucci, a sales representative for several printing companies, and his wife, Barbara, were feeling the recession's impact. A lot of competition from overseas cutting into the market had damaged his job prospects, he said. Then we took a nice big hit to our 401k. We had downsized our home before that. Then the economy took the icing off our retirement cake. We were about to start doing whatever we wanted to do. But, you know, you have to roll with this stuff, he said. The couple moved in 2013 to Colorado, where Mrs. Petrucci worked as a part-time dialysis nurse before returning to Atlanta. The couple have been replenishing their savings, and Social Security's full benefits kicked in last October when Mr. Petrucci turned 70. I can see continuing to work part-time, Mrs. Petrucci said, and be involved in a charitable organization. But as you get older, it gets harder to find a part-time situation. Fred Sanford, 65, planned to retire. Undecided. Actual retirement date, 2018, with an interim 2012 retirement. In 2004, Mr. Sanford moved to Orlando, Florida, to become a financial advisor at Merrill Lynch. But 2008 upset the whole apple cart, he said. It was a slow drip, drip, drip of clients withdrawing. But in August 2010, I lost a large client, and that tipped everything. His wife took a job helping special needs children. The couple rented out a room in their house and adopted a very frugal lifestyle, he said. And he decided to pursue a different line of work, but something he knew he could do, singing. Starting in college, he had been a member of a Chicago-area band, the Onstage Majority, whose four members played a number of instruments and had a wide repertoire. I decided to sing in supper clubs, restaurants, and other places as a solo act, singing what I call boomer tunes, he said. He sang a couple of nights a week and put the money toward the mortgage, but there was a lot of competition, so it wasn't always easy. Then he had a hip replacement, which made work more difficult. But in July, he will turn 66 and qualify for Social Security. I'm going for full retirement then, he said. Kitty Ruderman, 71, planned to retire in 2009, and her actual retirement date, or partially, was 2009. After decades as a legal secretary, Ms. Ruderman took a job in 1989 as secretary to John C. Whitehead, a former chairman of Goldman Sachs, who later became chairman of AEA Investors and led the effort to rebuild downtown Manhattan after the 2001 terrorist attacks. She retired from that position after two decades because, she said, I just wanted a life for myself. I thought I had factored everything in between my pension, medical benefits, and Social Security, but the rent on my apartment keeps going up, she said. Her daughter and grandson live nearby, she said, so I don't see myself moving out of New York, and I love the neighborhood around me. Last year, ReServe Incorporated, which helps place workers 55 and older in jobs, helped her find a data entry position 2 days a week for the New York Department of Corrections in an office near LaGuardia Airport. The job pays minimum wage, Ms. Ruderman said, but the commute from her home in Queens is fairly easy, and she can still spend time with her grandson and volunteer for AARP. I don't have to dip into savings, she said, and I plan on working as long as my health is fine. Patricia Cotton, 77, planned to retire in 2003. She actually retired in 2015. An immigrant from Trinidad, she was working 60 hours a week as a home care aide in 2012 when she was interviewed for a Times article about people working past 65. During the 2008 economic meltdown, Ms. Cotton's $150,000 retirement savings lost half its value. Her retirement funds took another blow when she incurred tax penalties for withdrawing her remaining individual retirement account money. That left her short of the extra funds she'd been counting on to supplement her Social Security check. To put more money away, she said, I stopped buying clothes, I cut back on everything, I just bought the food I needed. She continued to work as a home care aide in Hyattsville, Maryland, and saved every penny. But it was tough, she said. You do what you've got to do, she added, echoing many who've had setbacks on the road to retirement. Now, we have run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. I hope you'll listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed this. I'm Florence Nash, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is generously underwritten by Salibi Chiropractic, which welcomes the geriatric community with any neck, back, or hip issues. Call 919-782-4733. 919-782-4733. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time.